Hello and welcome to the March edition of Cultures of Las Vegas. You can probably guess why March is the month chosen to focus on Irish Americans and their contributions to our community. About 10% of local residents claim to have some degree of Irish roots. Of course, that number rises to about 100% on St. Patrick's Day. My name is George Knapp, moderator of today's program, and in my day job, I'm an investigative reporter for KLAS-TV, and yes, I have Irish blood. My paternal grandmother is from Ireland. And our conversation, I think, for the next 30 minutes or so, 30 minutes, is that all? They do know we're Irish, right? Is going to highlight contributions made by Irish Americans to the melting pot that is the Las Vegas community, Clark County. My guests, the other panelists today, Terry Murphy is a one-woman Irish Tourism Bureau. She's the former honorary Irish Council in Nevada. Yeah. They never replaced you, though, right?
Not yet.
They can't. How could they?
They could try.
And, you know, and has she has strong-armed and talked generations of locals into visiting Ireland. In her day job, she runs Strategic Solutions, a public affairs consulting company deeply involved in political issues, charitable causes, and businesses that are vital to the local economy. Diana Kenny Toogood, Southern Nevada Sons and Daughters of Erin. You're going to tell us what that organization does. Brian McMullen, owner of McMullen's Irish Pub. We know what goes on at a place like that. Pubs are, of course, a vital part of this community and Irish life as well. And Dr. Kian McMahon is a UNLV historian and author, and we're all going to join this conversation. Terry, I want to start with you. That number, 10%, of locals having Irish blood, is that solid?
That's 10% of Nevadans, yes. We're one of the higher levels of in the nation. And that started, actually Dr. McMahon might be able to elucidate on that a little bit, but in the 1840s and 50s up in the northern part of the state with the building of the railroad and the mining industry.
I wondered because I know a couple of years ago I did a DNA test and I grew up thinking, all right, I know my grandmother is Irish, but the rest of my family, I figured, was German. And I get this DNA test back, and it says, I don't have any German at all. It's all UK, British Isles, Irish, and Scandinavian.
Which lucky you.
I know. Diane, what is the Sons and Daughters of Erin?
We are a local Irish club. It's actually, the Sons and Daughters of Erin is nationwide, but we're the local chapter for that. And we meet on the second Wednesday of every month at McMullen's, and basically we are a social club that gets together, you know, Irish people or people with interest in Irish culture. You don't necessarily have to be Irish to join. Most of us are, though. We do a lot of charity work in the community, and we also put on the big Irish festival on St. Patrick's Day in Henderson.
And the parade.
The parade is mm-hmm. part of that festival. Uh-huh. We usually have about 65,000 people attend the festival. This year, because they're doing a bunch of construction in Henderson, we've had to scale it down a little bit. So it's going to be a little bit smaller. We usually have about 100 floats in the parade, and this year is probably going to be between 80 and 90. So it's not a big scale down, but a little bit.
And Terry, I was just kind of joking, sort of, mm-hmm. that you've taken everybody from Las Vegas to Ireland, but you've taken a lot.
I've taken a few tours, and a lot of people who are going over there usually give me a call and ask, what should I do, where should I go? And between Brian and I, and we tell everybody where to go, don't we, Brian?
Oh, we do, yeah.
And then once they go, they want to go back.
Yes.
That's a big problem.
The
yeah, they have to
Ireland
go back.
Once
yeah.
you go, you have to go back.
Brian, Terry had sent me some notes about the origin of the word pub, a public house, which
it's
is
a public house,
sort of
yeah.
a central part of Irish life.
Absolutely. It's where people in small villages meet, where people go. I mean, and it's a strange thing over here. You may not see a priest in a pub here because they'll think badly of them. But over there, it's an essential thing because if you don't go and your wife goes and you're not being a particular boy, he can only talk to you in the pub. So buy you a Guinness and they'll have a little chat.
How did you end up in Las Vegas?
Oh, casino business. I was in the casino business from 1968 in England and in South Africa and over here since 92.
Did you always know you were going to own a pub here?
No. I finished in the casino business on the 31st of December, 1999, And I started doing work for the Irish Pub Company out of Dublin, built 700 pubs around the world. I didn't build 700 pubs, they did. And I acted as their agent, so Nine Fine Irishmen, Fordow's, a number of casinos. They've built, I think, about 100 in the United States, and I haven't done, I've done with seven of them. And it's not as good as it used to be in terms of building them. I mean, they are building a few a year, but people quite a lot at one particular time, yes.
And other than the Sons and Daughters of Erin, do you find your place is a meeting place for Irish people who are here visiting?
I'm wearing the shirt because England play Ireland on Sunday, 7 o'clock in the morning rugby, as part of a Six Nations tournament rugby. So we could have 100 Irish there, tourists. And we'll also have locals because I support the local Las Vegas Irish team, which is the fifth biggest rugby club in the whole country. They have four teams and yes.
Irish English competition, probably very friendly.
We would love to beat them on Sunday. There's no other, you know, we won't be too upset afterwards. We'll be upset with ourselves. We love to beat them.
So, Kian, you have studied the Irish in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I studied the Irish in Ireland and Irish emigration more broadly in the times in which the Irish began coming to the United States in the largest numbers, which was in the mid-19th century. Most of my research is on the East Coast, but I have looked at the American West in some ways, yeah.
And you wrote a book about it.
I've written it, yeah. My book is called The Global Dimensions of Irish Identity, and it looks at the historical roots. Nowadays, of course, as your listeners know, 70 million people around the world, including about 40 million in the United States, identify as being Irish. When I was looking at the newspapers and the documents from the 1840s, though, I realized that they connected being Irish with being on the island of Ireland. And by 150 years later, you could be Irish anywhere in the world. So my book looks at the kind of historical dimensions of that and how that developed. But I am interested in the Irish in the West. In some ways, the Irish have been written out or maybe imagined out of the history of the American West, mm-hmm. because for two reasons. So for a long time, Irish historians assumed that after the Great Famine of 1845 to 1855, in which the potato on which the Irish population was heavily reliant was wiped out, the assumption was that Irish immigrants, when they went to the United States and Canada, didn't want to farm anymore. Well, that actually turns out wasn't true. They got into farming. It's just that they got a lot of jobs on the East Coast. And the other side of the debate, which I thought was very interesting, is that a lot of American historians thought of the American West and the frontier as a place of rugged individualism. And that idea of the West as a place of rugged individuals didn't fit with the notion of Irish as Catholics, clannish, superstitious, etc. So the Irish are part of the story of the American West. It's just that we're learning those dimensions now.
You know, immigration is always a hot topic here and everywhere around the world. People tend to forget that the Irish were sort of the low rung of the ladder for a long time and were on the receiving end of the kinds of attacks and stereotypes that other ethnic groups and nationalities are experiencing now.
Very much so. And there are today estimated to be approximately 50,000 undocumented Irish in the United States. So it's still an issue for the Irish in America.
Undocumented, that they slip across the border and
maybe overstay a visa or what have you and begin working or starting their own businesses or what have you. And yeah, it's something that has to be dealt with when and if comprehensive immigration reform happens. My granddad came from County Armagh in Northern Ireland, and he went to fight in World War I, had 9 children, all of whom were very industrious. My dad was a pipe fitter, helped to build the World Trade Center in New York City. I had an uncle who was a police officer. One was a Secret Serviceman. My aunt was principal of the first School of the Deaf in New York, St. Joseph School of the Deaf. So I think the Irish experience has added a tremendous amount to the American experience as well.
How often do you go back to Ireland?
Oh, I've been going back every year, actually. I've been going back every year, mainly because of whiskey. Mainly because, not the fact that I drink, but the, you know, whiskey. The prohibition, when Ireland dominated, Irish whiskey dominated America before prohibition, not Scotch, Irish. But when prohibition happened, they had nowhere to sell it because that's where they sold it, here. And that killed off, they had 37 distilleries in Dublin. They had no distilleries 5 years ago. But now the Irish Tourist Board and the Irish government are pushing the fact that they see how well Jameson has done in this country. So it's a huge push, and I think there'll be 40 by the end of 21. So I go back because of that and to see how the progress is going for that, because I have the most brands of Irish whiskey in the world. So,
well, the whiskey boom has been good for you.
Not that we sell them all, but, you know, a whole range of them, and it's going to get more and more and more. And they'll be able to, they can't vie with Scotland at the moment, or with Scotch, because it's so ingrained through the colonies and through here, people want Scotch. You know, you don't get $50,000, $100,000 bottles of Scotch, but you now, they're starting to do, there's just one the other day, $35,000, but they mostly will not be drunk. They most will be sold like paintings, you know, kept and sold. But it's becoming huge.
How many brands do you have, Brian?
Well, I think by tonight, I might have, tomorrow night, I might have 146. I got 140 here.
Do you have a sense, Kian, about how closely Irish Americans follow Irish politics and vice versa? The Irish, how much they follow our politics?
Yeah, I think that there are close connections that, but that those connections are episodic. In other words, they come and go. There's times when they're warmer than at others, right? And that makes sense. So I read the Irish Times every day online, which is the main Dublin newspaper, and American immigration, which Terry referred to earlier, is a huge issue that's covered carefully in the Irish press, exactly for the reason that Terry suggested. I mean, there's lots of families in Ireland who are directly affected by the immigration policy. It's not something that's distant to Irish families. It's something that impacts them on a daily basis. And then while most Americans may not have been following the ups and downs of the latest election in Ireland, there was an election last week, I'm sure most Americans probably aren't following it, but a lot of Americans would have understood the role that Ireland and the relationship between Ireland and Britain played in the huge debate over Brexit.
Yeah.
And so at times it becomes more and more, we'll say, important in each other's eyes. I'll also say that Ireland is a unique country in that, could you imagine if on the 4th of July, the President of the United States went to London and the Secretary for Commerce went to Ottawa and all these major ministers in the government went or left Ireland, left the United States on the 4th of July. That's what happens in Ireland. Like, Irish government, the main Irish government players leave Ireland on St. Patrick's Day to foster their connections with governments. The biggest example, of course, being when our Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, comes to the White House and has his annual St. Patrick's Day audience with the President, and he gives him a bowl of shamrocks and everybody smiles. But it's unique that a country of Ireland's size could have the ear of the American President every year, guaranteed.
Americans tend to not pay attention to anything that happens outside our borders. We have only the thinnest understanding of what goes on in the rest of the world. In general, can you help us understand where the Irish are on Brexit? We've got a general idea here, very thin, about Brexit and how that works and what it means. Where were the Irish in this discussion?
Yeah, so I would say that generally speaking, the population in the Republic of Ireland, and Terry and your other guests may be able to clarify this, is that generally speaking, the Republic of Ireland considers the European Union to be a positive development and considers the European Union to be a good thing. And so most people within the Republic of Ireland would consider Brexit to be an accident, or sorry, a mistake, like a mistake economically, politically, culturally, etc. The north of Ireland, of course, Northern Ireland, is more complicated in that a large percentage of that, about half of that percent of that population, considers themselves part of Britain. And about half generally consider themselves to be part of Ireland. And so the politics and the decisions within Northern Ireland are more complicated. But generally speaking, I would say that Irish people consider Brexit to be a mistake. And the problem is that if the border along Ireland between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland becomes a border for Europe and has soldiers and watchtowers put on it to control immigration, that does provide the potential to reignite the troubles, which were the low-intensity guerrilla warfare of the 1980s and 90s, which nobody wants to go back to.
Did I just read about it, a move to unify the two again, or discussion
about
that?
There is talks that perhaps one way to overcome the problems presented by Brexit is to give the people of Northern Ireland a chance to make their own democratic decision as to whether they would prefer to remain within Britain or prefer to remain or rejoin, we'll say, Ireland.
And in fact, the majority of people in Northern Ireland did not vote to leave the EU.
Oh, yeah, and
so,
that's an important
point.
That's an important point.
The other thing for context is the island of Ireland is about a third the size of Nevada, and the population of the island is about 6 million, with about 4.5 million being in the Republic and 1.5 being in Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. It gets complicated, mm-hmm. Isn't it?
And did they follow our politics enough to make a judgment on whether we're crazy or not? Or,
they do. In my experience, they do, because being an American, people, you know, ask.
So you go there and
yes. What are you people doing? I think they follow it way more than, they know a lot more about us than we know about them. For sure.
Brian, when you travel, do they ask you political questions? After they ask, can they go along with you? That is.
Yes, they do. I have strong views, but because I have a pub, sure, I don't deal with religion or politics, because it's, you know, I would have 50% Republicans and 50% Democrats, and sometimes you don't know who's what.
And neither of those topics ever get discussed in pubs, right?
No, they shouldn't. Sometimes they do. I mean, I had an Irish gentleman in, he's complaining about immigration, how terrible it was, and he may have only been lived here 10 years. And I had to remind him, because he was complaining about where people were coming over the border, I had to remind him, you have thought about that once and you shouldn't be saying that. Just keep quiet. You don't know anything. And he did keep quiet about it because, you know, Irish were really badly treated. I mean, there's no doubt, historical fact, they were badly treated when they first got. And they fought on both sides of the Union, and they fought on the Confederate side. Got killed on both sides. Brothers fought brothers. They still weren't that well treated afterwards.
There were a lot of Irish soldiers in the cavalry and that settled the American West,
which,
as well, as I recall.
Yeah,
the
which
Irish
shows
Brigade
you what happens today too.
War.
They fight in Afghanistan, in Iraq. They come back. They can't become citizens. A number of them. So, you know, it's difficult. It's not for me to judge it, but it's for me to say.
In the
people feel that.
7 or 8 minutes we got left, let's drum up a little tourism for Ireland. What you tell people to go see, Terry, when you urge them to go over?
Well, you know, it's a small enough country that you can see a lot of it in a short amount of time, but you kind of end up wanting to stay because it just grows on you. The people grow on you. Everybody's very friendly and likes to have a chat. They want to hear about you. The thing that I was recently there, and the thing that stood out to me the most was that it didn't seem to me that time was money. You know, how we're all in a bit of a rush here and over there. People want to know about you. They want to know where you're from and what you do and what you like. So to go there, Dublin is it's a European city. It's got a lot of history. There's a brand new museum there that I really found myself liking. It's called EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum about all of the people who've left Ireland and gone and made huge impacts all around the world. So that's one thing. In fact, DNA was one of the discoveries of an Irish person. The White House was designed by an Irishman. So lots and lots of things. Submarines were designed by Irish people. So lots of gifts there, and it was very interesting. But it's also, there's a juxtaposition of history and modernism. So you see Google and Facebook building very modern buildings right next to carefully preserved buildings that are important to the history of the Republic of Ireland, right? So that's very interesting. And then the west of Ireland is just the most gorgeous scenery I've ever seen in the world.
That's what you've told me every time we've talked about it.
So you can drive around the entire island and you can do a whiskey tour of, you know, all the distilleries, not necessarily just to drink a lot of whiskey, but there's a lot of culture in the creation of Irish whiskey. There's a lot to do and see there.
I think if you're American and you go to any other country, I don't think you'll be treated better than in Ireland. Irish love America.
Yeah.
I think love with a capital L. Mm-hmm. And they always open, treat you with open arms. They welcome you with open arms. That's what I've always experienced.
No matter your politics, anyway. Either. They like to talk about it one way or the other, right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely, yeah.
Wherever you fall, a good argument is always a good thing, right?
Do you see Americans increasingly looking into their DNA, genealogical roots, and then tracking down their Irish relatives? Just show up and, hey, I'm here. Knock on the door. Is that your members engage in any of that? Do you?
Yes, I mean, we have most everybody, I would say, well, a lot of people in the club have done their DNA, and yes, like to trace back. In fact, one of the women in the club, her last name is Kennedy, or was Kennedy, and my last name was Kenny, and so she said, "Oh, but I have some Kennys in my." So yeah, it sort of gets talked about and that sort of thing. I don't know if I would just, I have still relatives there, so I'm told, but I don't know that I would just show up and knock on their door.
It does happen, though.
It happens, right? I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get people because of the pub. They come in and they think I know everything about it. I don't. Terry knows everything about it. But they come in and say, where should we go? What should we do? We're looking for, be it Kelly, be it Murphy, be it whatever else. And a number of them have come back. Some haven't found their people. They know which village they come from. Some only know the village that they come from, and they find people. I could talk a whole show on what they say about when they come back.
Well, tell us a little bit.
Well, quickly, this guy came in one day, and I was serving at the bar years ago, and he said, I've got to talk to you. I said, okay, I'll be with you in a moment. I came over to him, and he said, my mother and father went to Ireland. They knew the village they were at. They were both retired. They'd been married 50 years or whatever, but the wife was keen on finding her ancestors. The husband wasn't as keen, but he went along. And they went to a pub in the town. They didn't know who they obviously knew the names and whatever, and they spoke to people, and one lady came up, one who worked there came up, don't talk to them. I'll take you to my house and we can have a chat about it. Took it to the house. They took him to the house. The husband wasn't too happy. She got on a chair, sat them down, got on a chair, went on top of the closet, picked out a cardboard box and started leafing through these photographs. You know, as you used to do, you didn't look on your phone, you'd listen to the photographs that you never put up, but they were always in this box. And she pulled out a big one and she turned it to them. She said, I don't know who these people are. It was a wedding photograph. It was their wedding photograph.
Wow.
You know, there's hairs on my arms went up. Because people, you're over in America, you've gone, you're two generations back, but you still, there are people who send it back to brothers or sisters. My daughter got married or my whatever, and people get it. They don't know who you are. They just know that these are long-lost cousins, and they stick it in the box. And that, and he said, you don't have to believe me. My parents are coming in, and they'll tell you.
And in general, the Irish are, it happens enough they get used to.
I've heard multiple stories of similar things.
I think it's a wonderful thing to know about your ancestors and whatever else. You get that camaraderie, and they become friends, and long distance as it may be, you know?
Kian, while we have a chance, tell us about your book that you wrote, what the title of it is, what's in it, and maybe we can sell a couple copies.
Well, thanks, George. So, so the first book I wrote is published in 2015, and it was called The Global Dimensions of Irish Identity. And I was interested in the ways in which newspapers in the 1840s and the 1850s were used as a medium for connecting between Irish people around the world. We think nowadays, as you just referred to photographs, we pick up the phone and we text or communicate, email somebody very quickly. In the 19th century, I mean, early 19th century, information only moved as fast as a ship could carry it. You know what I mean? So it took weeks and months for information to be transmitted. That meant that information was that little bit more important in some ways. And so I'm interested in that. Terry was just referred to the Epic Museum in Dublin. I grew up in Dublin. I'm, of course, partial to Dublin and all things great about it. There are many. One great thing beside the Epic Museum is a replica of a sailing ship from the years of the famine. And it's called the Jeannie Johnson, which was a real ship. And it's a living museum. You can go on with the docent, and you can go down, and you can climb into steerage, as it was called. And going to this ship, this museum, several times, sparked in myself an interest in the experiences of emigrants at sea. So I'm currently working on a new book, which I'm calling The Coffin Ship. And that's it. That seeks to understand the strategies and tactics that emigrants used at sea during the Great Famine.
Well, Kian and Brian and Diane and Terry, great to have you here and share this with us. And I guess the only question is, are we going in one car to the pub, or are we all going, we're driving
separately?
You're
very
welcome. Thank you. Right.
That's it for us with this edition of Cultures in Las Vegas. Thank you.